Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am so excited for this episode. If you are a frequent listener of the podcast, you know that we have a Patreon, and one of the perks in our Patreon for executive producer levels is you get to come on the show and do an episode with me. You get to pick a case, one of your favorites, or one that you want to do, and then come on the show and do it with me. We have our first patron take me up on that offer. Alana has been a patron from the very beginning of the podcast. We could not love her any more than we possibly do. And she's also a pathologist assistant, and she's fascinating. Her job to me is absolutely fascinating. She frequently messages me stories and, you know, quirky things that happen to her at work. And she's an amazing artist, by the way. And she's just an overall amazing person. So I was really excited when she reached out and said, yes, I want to come on the show and discuss this case. Alana currently lives and works in Texas, and the case that she chose is Houston's Candyman, real name Dean Corll. Absolutely heinous case, and one that I honestly didn't know much about until my conversation with Alana. This episode is going to be a discussion with her. We're going to cover the Candyman Dean Corll case, and then just basically get to know you. Who are you? What do you do? That sort of thing. Absolute blast. I laughed so much. I hope you find it humorous too. I know a lot of people don't like true crime podcasts with a lot of banter. I love this series personally because there are so many walks of life who enjoy true crime. Just in our patrons as a whole, I have everything from PhD forensic analysts and psychologists who have in fact worked with criminals and criminology to school teachers to college students. And it's so fascinating to me to discuss various cases, Lori Vallow, Suzanne Morphew, I mean, Dean Corll, with people from all different walks of life. It's very important to me to foster that kind of environment in our Patreon. And so this episode, there is a lot of banter, which, guys, she works in a lab as a pathologist assistant. She deals with death and weird medical anomalies all day long. So I have a feeling that you're going to want to hear some of the stories. Before we get into that, though, let's just get our quick housekeeping out of the way. You're listening to We Saw the Devil. I'm Robin. Our website is wesawthedevil.com. You can also find us across all social media under that handle. And if you're interested in becoming a patron, you can do so at patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. Also, this week has a full docket, guys, because we have Lori Vallow's arraignment coming later this afternoon. Now, this episode is going to be released this morning. Later on this afternoon, after Lori Vallow's arraignment, I will have a surprise episode for you with a surprise guest. Very excited about this. And it may be someone that you know. Beyond that, later this week is a topic that I've been obsessing over for a couple weeks now. And the episode title is What the Fuck is Going On in Ukraine? basically a primer of what's going on, how we got to where we are. Because guys, let's be honest, what is happening there is a true crime. We can turn on the TV or look at a stream and witness atrocities and war crimes. If you're saddened and horrified by the images coming out of Ukraine every single day, but don't quite understand the political significance or the events leading up to it, like why are we here? Why is Russia attacking Ukraine? Then this will be the episode for you. This podcast has never really done, you know, geopolitical topics before, but I feel so strongly about the events in Ukraine and beyond just, say, changing a Facebook profile picture, let's discuss why it's happening. But I'm going to go ahead and air my little sit-down fireside chat with Alana. Again, we're going to be talking about all the gross, squishy things, and then followed by her covering the story of Candyman, or Dean Corll. So Alana, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. I am so excited to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated by you. Kind of in a creepy way, I'll admit it. But what is it that you do for a living?
I disassemble parts of people that have been removed during surgery.
And I can't imagine. Everyone knows that we had Iris on a while ago and talked about her experience, as an autopsy assistant and whatnot. But you have a very, very fascinating job. I can't imagine what you've actually seen. Like, name off the top of your head, what's the wildest thing that you have examined?
25 centimeter melanoma. So it was the size of a pizza?
Jesus. And what body part did that come off of?
Came off of a woman's shoulder.
So she had a melanoma the size of a pizza just chilling out on her shoulder like her twin.
Yeah, she finally came in because her family was complaining of the smell.
Oh, no.
Yep.
Oh.
It had like a little satellite melanoma next to it that was like 2 centimeters. It's like, oh, it's a baby. But if you think about it, that's a huge freaking melanoma.
That's massive. You know, you do incredibly important work. And it are all of the samples that you examine, like from surgery in particular, or do you sometimes get accidents or things like that? Or is it primarily like biopsies? Oh,
pathology assistants get traumatic amputations. we're basically Iris, but during surgery, kind of, or on live patients. But we also, where I learned, we would take turns in the morgue. And there's a fine line between what should go to the morgue and what should come, especially with non-term infants. Where does it go? Does it go to the morgue? Does it come to us? Where does it go?
And you get a lot of that.
Yeah, I have done a lot of that. The most fascinating thing for me is, like, you know, they have all these, like, I'm in Texas. You know, we have the 6-week abortion ban, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what about molar pregnancies? Nobody ever people talk about ectopic. You know, I've heard like people say, you know, like, you know, the delusional people that say, oh, yeah, well, they can just put it in the uterus, which is not technically a thing anyway. But molar pregnancies are where the genetic information is lost from either the sperm or the egg.
Oh, wow.
So instead of a baby, what you get is like this grape-like villous clusters, which is chorionic villi, which would become the placenta. But there is no baby and there is no placenta.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the HCG that pregnancy test for, it goes through the roof on this. Human chorionic gonadotropin is what it is. And you have a much higher chance of getting choriocarcinoma from this. So the saddest thing I saw was a woman who had had like 7 molar pregnancies.
No.
Yeah. And she was bound and determined that she wasn't going to have a molar pregnancy this time. So she just didn't go to the doctor while she was preterm. So she came in at 9 months and said, okay, it's time for me to deliver my baby. And she lost her uterus.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because it was a 9-month-old molar pregnancy. I don't even know how she lived that long. I mean, she didn't have cancer and it was okay, but, you know, she's very lucky. And just that it causes your blood pressure to go up so high that I don't understand how she made it 9 months.
Wow.
But she was determined that she was going to have a normal pregnancy. And, you know, that's one of those things when you're dealing with like poor populations, since it was the public hospital, mm-hmm. they're not going to get genetic counseling.
Yeah.
So she didn't know. And I guess nobody had explained it to her.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
So
she really, really wanted that baby.
And so she basically kind of played the, well, I'm not going to go to the doctor to find out if there's not going to be a baby. I'm just going to go through my pregnancy. And if I can will it into fruition, more or less.
Basically, no news is good news.
God, that's so sad.
I know. And you'll see these people talk about these, you know, pregnancy bans. It's like, well, what about Mueller pregnancies? What about then? That's not a pregnancy, but if you can't do anything past 6 weeks.
Legally, in terms of, say, the abortion ban in your state, would the Mueller pregnancy mm-hmm. count?
That is one of those save the life of the mother sort gotcha. Of things. That's, there is no baby. You can have a partial Mueller pregnancy where there can be a fetus, which is like if you're fertilized by two sperm, which is a really weird course of event. But all these things happen. So people, you know, also we have, you know, the anti-trans stuff here.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
like, trust me, I know there is a huge range of what is normal. Because I've seen people come in, you know, they're like 23 years old and they don't know why they haven't had a period and they're androgen insensitive. They are literally male.
I've watched a handful of documentaries, too, about how people learn that they're intersex, too, you know, when they're in their mm-hmm. 30s or 40s, even.
Oh, yeah. People don't realize that, you know, you can have XXY, you can have XXO, you can have. So like to say a woman is XX. You can have XO because the X, you know, mm-hmm. is the one that you can't have O, but you can have XO. It's like, oh, you're not XX, but you're not XY, you're XO. And, you know, like ectopic pregnancies, there was one woman who she had an ectopic and couldn't get one where she was, and it ruptured when she was flying over the Atlantic Ocean. And it was an ectopic pregnancy that it was like, I think it was like 15 weeks, which is not viable, but it was big.
Yeah.
I'm like, how did this? It must have been implanted really close to the uterus. It must have just been right there. Because, I mean, man, and she lived and yikes.
We have a lot of listeners who early 20s still trying to, you remember back in the day when you were in your early 20s and you were like, what do I want to do with my life? What direction do I want to go in? But life was sweet.
That's when I moved to Texas.
What would you tell them if they're interested in, you know, doing the kind of work that you're doing? Do you have any advice, career advice for them?
Well,
must have a strong stomach and not like dead feet.
Just must have a strong stomach. Must be able to withstand horrible, horrible aromas. Plus, you have to be used to smelling chemicals because lab smells like chemicals. We have xylene and all these. When I first started in a pathology lab, I'm like, oh my God, what is that smell? And then the next day I couldn't smell anything.
It was just gone.
It was just gone. It's like, okay, I'm fine now. Take as much science as you can. I am very strong proponent of STEM, women in STEM, and would always say, go do it. Take as much science as you can, but you know about it, know about why things are the way they are, mm-hmm. and then make the best choices from there.
Well, you are a badass, and I am so excited to have you on. Were you a morbid child? Did you have a good case of the morbs when you were a kid?
I have a picture of me and my brother as children, and I am wearing a pink dress, and I still look goth, and I'm like 5 years old, and it's like, I look so goth, and my brother's just cute little blonde boy, and it's like, I'm this dark-haired, very morbid-looking girl in a pink dress. Yes.
I think everyone expected me to go into something with a health field or surgery or something. My aunt and uncle, or my uncle in particular, has one of the largest cattle ranches on the eastern side of the country here in Tennessee. And so they would have slaughterhouse, right? Obviously. Mm-hmm. And they had a bucket. I don't know why or where this bucket of entrails came from, but I was like 5 or 6 years old. And there's a video of me out there somewhere of me literally playing in the bucket livers and hearts and stuff. And I'm like feeling this pig's heart and whatnot. And looking back on that, I'm terrified. I'm mortified. I can't imagine what my aunt and uncle were looking at me like, why is this 5-year-old child giggling and playing with a dead heart? But I digress.
Yeah. Yeah. Why are they doing that? And what diseases are they going to get from these shows?
Luckily none. Luckily none. But I think that was the last of my aunt trying to give me like dollhouses and stuff to play with. No.
Well, see, I wasn't allowed to have like dolls and stuff. I was supposed to be raised in a gender neutral environment, which meant I was raised anti-girl.
Oh, wow. So really?
I wasn't allowed to have dolls. I wasn't allowed to have like a tea set. I wasn't allowed to have kitchen equipment or anything like that. You know, like, you know, any of this toy kitchen stuff.
Toy vacuum.
I wanted one of those ovens, those easy bake ovens when I was a little kid. And I would put that on my Christmas list every year. Never got one. So what I did is, you know, we had an unused set of drawers in the house where I grew up. So I made a dollhouse out of it. And I painted rocks like bugs. So I had the big bug apartments. That was my dollhouse.
Oh,
I know. It was kind of sad. It's like, and I would say to the state, encourage your children to go into science. Don't make them anti-girl.
Yeah, there's a big difference between that, yes. Between gender neutral and anti.
Yeah.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Well, we need to get you an easy bake oven. You need to realize your dream.
Yeah, I don't bake much now, so.
Can you really call an easy bake oven baking, per se?
No, not really. But I always wanted to make one of those little cupcake things, you know, one of those little cakes, and yeah.
They were very cute. If it makes you feel any better, I didn't have one either. So. Okay. One day, Alana, we just need to meet up and each have an easy bake oven.
Yes. We'll all sit here. We'll sit there and make, we'll ice our little cakes, our tiny little cakes.
We can be like an episode of Chopped on our easy bake oven.
I'm going to make mine chocolate chip.
Were you into true crime from a young age? You know, for me, middle school, yes. I was into Jack the Ripper and, you know, stuff like that. Like, it was immediate.
Well, you know, I remember because we used to go back to Tennessee to visit my grandparents in the summer. And so my parents would drive us to Seattle from, which is like a 4-hour schlep from where I grew up. And we would stay at a hotel on the SeaTac Strip. And my parents would joke around about the Green River Killer being out there, you know, because that's where he looked for people on the SeaTac Strip, right up and down that road.
And he was active during that period, right?
And he was very active during that period. Oh. So my parents would joke about that. It's like, if you don't do it, I'm going to hang you out the window and leave you for the Green River Killer to get you.
Wow.
Thanks, Dad.
No trauma there.
Yeah. So I remember that. I also remember Wesley Allen Dodd. He actually lived in Richland for a while and yes. Tried to kidnap somebody from behind my house.
The movie theater one or the park?
No. That actually happened in Vancouver, but he lived in Richland for a while.
Huh.
And he tried to kidnap one of my classmates.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. He got caught, you know, because she was with her sister and they reported him and then he got arrested. And, you know, if you read his like life story, it'll talk about when he got in trouble, when he lived in the Tri-Cities and his dad worked at the Hanford Reservation. It's like, yeah, that happened behind my house.
That's crazy. Did you ever lay eyes on him physically? Like, did you ever?
Not that I know of, because I was a kid at the time, so I really don't know. Fun fact, he was the last person put to death by hanging in Washington State. Mm-hmm. I also went to high school with the synagogue shooter from Seattle. He was really mentally ill.
So you had personal interactions
with him? My brother had more interaction with him because he was younger. My brother remembers him coming to a pasta feed at our house for like the cross country and track team. The month before he did the synagogue shooting, he was like taking off his pants at the local mall he was arrested for coming onto somebody and then taking off his pants in a fountain. I mean, there was some serious mental illness going on.
More red flags in the Soviet Union.
Lots of red flags. Red flags are not just party favors. They are warning signs.
Yes, that is very true. It's so interesting that so many of these cases that we read about in the true crime world and whatnot, that there were an absolute shit ton of red flags everywhere. Just either no systems
Wesley
in place.
Dodd before that happened, red flags, you know. I remember when they actually, I was in Texas in grad school when they arrested Gary Ridgway. And I'm like, holy shit, it actually was one guy.
That's crazy. There are some cases like East Area Rapist out of California, Green River Killer, BTK, that just terrorized whole regions.
Well, you know, growing up hearing about, you know, even Ted Bundy, because I was in Washington. So, of course, you heard about that, you know. You hear about how the Northwest was synonymous with, you know, like serial killers. But then you come to Texas and we've got the same thing here. Now, maybe it's just following me around, but I don't think so. I think it's just people haven't noticed, or people don't pay much attention until it's like knocking on their door, which is like, I had never heard of the case that I picked
really?
Before I moved to Texas. Yeah. I watched something called Crime Story on like the Learning Channel when it was actually learning stuff, you know, not just like Honey Boo Boo and all that stuff. When it was actually, you know, the Learning Channel, just like, you know, the History Channel is now the Ancient Aliens Channel.
But, yes. And this case was on it?
Yes. And I'm like, how come I've never heard about this? And then turns out this happened. I wasn't even a month old when this happened.
I don't remember how old I was or when this particular case came onto my radar. It's just like one of the random ones, because it kind of starts out just, I think that his name, right, is very interesting and kind of headline grabbing. But it follows kind of like your standard serial killer type of stuff until the end. And then it just kind of goes off the rails.
Yeah. And I think the reason that you don't hear as much about this case is because the whole shit show starts off with him dying.
Yep, exactly.
It's like he never went to trial. His mother claimed he was still innocent because her psychic told her he was innocent and that he wasn't gay.
Those psychics.
It's like, what? Well, his mom had a marrying issue. And this whole story is very interesting. It's like, I believe his mom, actually, I was reading about how she was one of the first people to use computer dating back in 1970s.
Oh, wow.
And that's how she met her third husband. Can you imagine how big that computer was?
No, I cannot. And that's crazy in the 70s, because like the 80s and early 90s brought us the TV dating. Remember where people would record themselves? Yeah. Some of the best videos on YouTube are just reels of the 80s and 90s, like TV dating, video dating. How far away is this case from you, like from where you are?
From where I am, this case occurred in Houston. Mm-hmm. I'm in Dallas, so it's about 4 hours away from where I am. My boyfriend grew up in Houston, and I tried to ask him some stuff about the locations, and I think he just blocked Houston out of his memory. think about Houston. Houston is very different than Dallas. Houston is like the you walk outside and literally the humidity hits you like a wall.
I'd die.
Oh,
I would have done that.
It's hot and it's humid and you just, everything wilts or droops.
I'm in Tennessee. Everyone knows I'm in the Nashville area, and in the summer here, I wake up in the morning and it's already, you know, 7 a.m. It's already 96 degrees with 98% humidity. It's just,
yeah.
Yeah.
Houston, Louisiana, New Orleans, because I lived in New Orleans when I was a very small child.
You're getting gother by the moment.
Sorry. I am. Yeah, I was I turned 5 there. And then we moved back to Washington. but yes, very goth. And I read Anne Rice as a kid, so.
Me too.
Yeah.
So I put this out there on the interwebs and Twitter. I said the location of the case that you'll be covering this evening, and no one got it. No one. Everyone guessed the yogurt shop murders.
Nope. That's way too modern.
So, Alana, what case did you pick?
I picked The Candyman, which is Dean Corll out of Houston, Texas. And this occurred it ended in 1973.
Crazy case. And I was so excited to see that you picked it. I know that in our conversations, you said that you wanted to pick something, you know, from Texas. And I was secretly hoping that this would be the one that you picked. I am so excited. This has nothing to do with Candyman, the movie, right?
Nothing. Nothing. There are several Candyman killers, you know. You have the Candyman. You have the one guy, I think he was also in Houston, who poisoned his kid by putting something in the pixie sticks.
Yep, I remember that too.
Yeah, I think that was also in Houston. And I did not have any idea this happened because, you know, you hear about body counts and you think Gacy, right? Well, Gacy actually cited this guy as part of the reason that he did this. And
really?
And buried him under his house.
I did not know that.
Yes.
That's interesting.
I thought it was really strange. And, you know, this took place in 1973. John Wayne Gacy bested it in 78. Not that we're like giving out awards for highest body count because, you know, really we shouldn't be encouraging people. But in the true crime field, you know, Gacy, you know, Green River Killer, you know, there are body counts out there. There are people who care about this. Murderpedia exists for a reason.
I think so far, isn't it the Luis Garavito out of Colombia, I believe?
Think so.
Yeah, I think that they've proven that he killed 138, but like potential.
Think about all the places that aren't reporting into this, you know, it's like, what about like small rural areas, third world countries? You know, this is really a first world problem that we hear about. We don't hear about it. What goes on in India, what goes on in China. We don't hear about what goes on in Russia. We might not hear everything.
What I've been working on, this episode for a couple months and researching it, but I haven't talked about it yet, is I'm not sure if you guys have heard of the Murder Accountability Project. Basically, what it is, it's a project where it's a nonprofit and they've gone together and they're like, so many murders are not being reported in the United States. So many. And they actually sued the FBI because the FBI isn't even reporting all of the murders that are taking place. So what they did is they contact local police departments and whatnot individually, and they get the raw data and they put it into their database. And they have files and data, like hard actual data, dating back all the way to like the early 1970s. Every serial killer imaginable, so on and so forth. They put, you know, the way that they're killed, total victim profiles, the whole bit. Well, they've actually been able to see clusters of where serial killers are probably likely operating all across America. And so what their entire thing is that there are a lot more serial killers out there currently, you know, acting than what the FBI and other people are saying.
The one thing I remember as a kid was like there was a TV miniseries called Chiefs, which would never be made these days. It was like this was back in the 80s. And it basically followed like several generations of sheriff in this one small southern town. There's a serial killer that is going on the entire time. And eventually they start digging people up at the end.
Oh, my God.
And I remember seeing that as a, you know, we weren't allowed to stay up that late as a kid, but I remember seeing this when it was on reruns when I got older. And it's like, this is at the same time as like North and South and, you know,
that entire
thing, you know.
Yeah.
No, that genre, you know.
I remember that era of television. But it's not surprising. Like, I'm a full believer. There's so much more shit that goes on that we're not privy to. And I think that Maine, especially, like, I lived in Portland, Maine for a decade. There's so much crime there that goes unreported because of the only thing keeping Maine alive is the tourism industry, period, full stop.
Well, so think about how often that goes on. Now, I'm not saying that there's this bizarre Mormon offshoot, and there's every 10 years, there's a different Mormon case. Mm-hmm. I will say there is one of those because, like, you have Elizabeth Smart, mm-hmm. you have Susan Powell. Mm-hmm. All those were just as crazy. You have the Lafferty murders.
Oh, the Lafferty ones.
I am so looking forward to Under the Banner of Heaven, the miniseries with Andrew Garfield.
There's a lot of shit that goes on in the world, but you're right. The Mormon, there's like every 10 years or so, something comes around from the land of the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
They take their turn.
So, I remember when I, not to date myself, when I graduated from high school, it was still just, I would ask my friends who are Mormon and they're like, no, polygamy's never been part of the church. And in the last, since that time, it's like, it's now accepted that polygamy was part of the history of the church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, ooh, what didn't I know?
Right.
I got into your podcast, you know, because I was really interested. It's like, ooh, yeah, here's the next one, because this is going to be ape shit. Is she still cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs?
See, and I think it's an unpopular opinion. I think that when Brittany and I did the episode previously, we kind of discussed it as well. But I truly believe that Lori Vallow believed in that. I don't think that she was just lying, you know, like she's some salacious devil of a woman who's like, oh, I'm going to kill my kids to get rid of them. I actually fully believe that she believed it, like in Chad Abel.
No, I think there's definitely some borderline personality going on in there because you see her go manic.
Mm-hmm.
You see her go manic and...
Yeah, completely.
But you see her do this with different husbands at different times. And, you know, you see her love bomb people and you see her. Ugh. I just remember seeing them in Hawaii when Nate Eaton was like, where are the kids?
Yep.
He's like, oh, that's great. We're glad you're scared. For, you know, it's like, you guys, there's something really wrong here. I mean, my dad and my relationship isn't the best. I mean, I love him, but I don't talk to him. He's still married to my mom. They've been married 50 years. It's like wonderful for them. But I remember him watching Susan Smith on TV, you know, after her kids were going, my babies. And I remember, and he's like, there's something not right with her. He is the least maternal, paternal person there is on the planet. And if he saw through her shit, everybody saw through her shit. And we all saw through Lori and Chad's, except for his kids, apparently.
Except for the kids. That must be, well, the case that I'm even potentially more interested in, maybe than Vallow, is the Suzanne Morphew case. And I don't know if anyone's seen Barry Morphew's plea to find her, but it was equally as bad. Suzanne, I love you. If someone has you, please come home. You are my life and stars. Like, it was that passionate, you know? And you can see right through it. And now that we know his movements and what happened, like, he killed her. There's no way that he did not kill her. 0% chance.
He took her ballot and voted for her.
Yeah, he took her ballot, but he knew she wasn't going to vote, or, you know, had she been alive, or he thought she could have been alive, couldn't she have dropped off an absentee ballot in a mailbox? He knew that she was gone, but his kids, same thing.
Everybody knew that she was gone.
Everybody, but his kids, same thing. They support, love him, hold his hand as he goes into the court, you know, each week.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And it might come down to, do I want to lose one parent or do I want to lose two?
I guess you really don't know which option you would take unless you get there or you're in that situation. But for me, myself, I could never. I would just say, fuck it, I'm an orphan, you know, at this point.
It's like you smothered / strangled / asphyxiated / whatever you did to our mother, but you're the one who's here, so we'll stand by you. Well, screw our stepmom. She can go because I know they're blaming her now.
Yeah.
not Morphew, but Valo.
Yeah, Valo, yeah.
I know they're
yeah.
blaming her now. It's like, I'm wondering what's going to happen at trial.
It's really interesting, especially in the Valo case, to separate, not separate. It looks like it's not going to be separated. It's going to be really interesting. I just wish the show would get on the road.
I think he wants to get as far away from her as possible right now.
Yeah. It's like, oh no.
Oh.
And she's like, nope, we're tethered.
And then, you know, to hear that when I heard about, you know, like when she was in the state hospital, oh yeah, call the church. What? No, that is not okay on any level, on any medical professional.
No, and that's actually something that made me really angry is, and not to piss off our listeners at all, but seeing how many people thought that was totally fine, that was totally acceptable thing for a licensed practitioner and a mental, you know, in a mental health facility to be like, call the church.
At a state mental health facility. It's like, what? No. What do you think they're going to do? I mean, she has tied herself to that man. She has tied herself to this fate. She tied her kids to this.
Yep.
No, nobody's going to save you, lady. You know, this needs to be taken care of. You sacrificed your children for the end of days. Now, where I grew up in Washington is a large percentage Latter-day Saint.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember going to LDS church with my locker partner for all 4 years. Yeah, I went to church with her. We were like in the, because it's like a 3-hour service. Well, it's like 3 hours long. But one of the things is like you go to like classes with people your age and they're like, they asked a question and it's like, what do you want done with you when you die? And I said, I wanted to be cremated. And you would have thought I had just said something profane.
Really?
Well, I didn't know that wasn't acceptable. So they don't like to cremate people because you want to reclaim your body when you come back.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, I've got a lot of legs that I have at work that aren't with their bodies. Because the people are still alive. I've got legs. They don't need them anymore. Now, there is something where you can request your leg back and we can release it to a funeral home, but that doesn't really happen.
Oh my God. All I'm picturing.
It's only happened once.
Oh my, I'm just picturing ghosts flooding into your office and trying to like get those legs
need
back.
That leg. Yeah, I need that leg back.
Excuse me.
I need that leg or those legs or those toes or.
My God.
It's like, I need that because if not, I won't be able to come back. Well, I'm sorry. Your leg has been incinerated.
They can just drag themselves like the zombies on The Walking Dead.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you about the funniest story. And apparently there was a traumatic amputation on a road crew and they brought the traumatically amputated leg in an ice chest. And when we would get limbs at the hospital, we would take care of them. They're too big to put in formalin. So we would just wrap them in bags, you know, put the name on it and everything and put them in the refrigerator until they were signed out. And then we would dispose of them with the medical waste in the microwave on the bin on the loading dock. Well, he decided that when they got done grossing in this leg, they just put it back in the bottom of the fridge in the ice chest, right? Well, so when it comes time to disposing of this, he just takes the ice chest down to the loading dock, doesn't put it in the bin, just leaves it on the loading dock. Somebody decides, hey, man, free ice chest.
Oh, no.
3 hours later, the FBI showed up.
Did they find it?
Yes, they took the ice chest home with them.
Oh, my God.
Somebody said, hey, free ice chest, let's go. I don't know if it was somebody who worked there. I don't know if it was a homeless person. I don't know who took it. But somebody, when they opened up that ice chest, went, oh, shit.
How did they call the FBI?
The FBI just showed up. I don't know. I guess the police called the FBI and because it was hospital.
Wow. That's not a surprise you want to have.
No. There were a lot of different things that he needed to do. After that, we had to destroy all ice chests. We were deceived.
Because
there is nothing that sounds worse than sawing apart a styrofoam ice chest.
The more you know, never pick up a picnic item that's sitting outside of a hospital.
Correct. Never. Not on the loading dock.
I would just keel over.
At least it like had all the patient information on the inside, which is good and bad. That's a HIPAA violation, but they could trace.
Light at the end of the tunnel. Alana, since this is your case, you researched, you got ready. I am ready for you to teach me.
August 8th, 1973. And the evening starts out, what do you do in the 70s? In Houston. Well, it's the 70s. No video games. What do? You huff paint, apparently.
Wow.
I don't know, but that seems to be like the drugs and huffing paint seem to be like the preferred means to getting these Dean Corll's victims. So it actually starts out on August 7th, 1973, before midnight. Timothy Curley, who is 19, and Wayne Henley, who is 17, hey, Tim, come over to my friend Dean's house. We're going to huff some paint, get high, have some fun, right? Well, he picks up his friend Tim, takes him back to a house in Pasadena, Texas, 2020 Lamar Street, Pasadena, Texas, which is actually Dean Corll's dad's house, but his dad isn't there. He's living in it by himself. So he invited Tim to party, quote unquote, at Corll's, which is basically sniffed paint and drank until midnight. And then they drove, which makes me feel really safe on the roads. And when they were out, they ran into Rhonda Williams, who is 15 years old. She was living at home with her dad. They had gotten into a fight. Her dad was an abusive alcoholic. Her boyfriend had disappeared. Boyfriend / fiance had disappeared a year earlier. So if she's 15 at this time, she was 14 when she was engaged to the guy who disappeared. So,
gross.
Wow. Okay. They did things young back then. Wayne Henley kind of had a crush on her and said, okay, well, you can come back with us and we're all going to go back to Dean Corll's house. They got there at 3 a.m. Corll is furious that Henley has brought a girl back and that he has ruined everything. Speaking as a girl, I don't think we've ruined everything, but I have different things of fun in mind than what they had planned.
Right.
So Dean chilled out while the teens drank tough and did pot till they passed out. Sounds like a good 3 a.m. I mean, wow. This is like, what would you think if there was an adult man having teenagers sniffing paint at their house?
Something's wrong.
There's something really damn wrong. Now, maybe this was common in the 70s and I'm just not sure of it, but I don't think so. But Henley woke up in handcuffs, his mouth taped shut, and his ankles bound. But Curley and Rhonda Williams were bound with rope, gagged with adhesive tape, and lying face down on the floor. Timothy Curley had been stripped naked. Dean is pissed still about the girl coming back. Starts waving around a .22 caliber pistol, which I don't know anything about guns. I just know that'll shoot you. Henley said, I guess he took the tape off his mouth, agreed that he would help with the torture and murder of both Williams and Curley if Dean let him go. And I guess Dean has a soft spot for Wayne, obviously, because he lets him go. So they take Tim Curley and Rhonda Williams into Dean's bedroom, and they have what is described as a torture board, which is basically this, like, 6-foot by 3-foot piece of plywood with holes and handcuffs attached through the holes. So one of them is strapped to the board face down and one of them is face up. but if they're standing, they're both standing. Okay. Dean says, look, you do the girl and I'll do the boy. He goes up to Rhonda and Rhonda asked him, is this really happening? And he's like, Wayne says, yes, this is really happening. And then she goes, are you going to do anything about it? And Wayne Henley grabs Dean's pistol while Dean is assaulting Timothy. And this probably led to his death later on, like 40 years down the road, because, you know, this is a traumatic life-altering event.
Absolutely.
He says, I can't have you killing all of my friends. You know, it's like, my ears perk up. It's like, why did he say that?
Right.
And so Dean's like, oh, shoot me, Wayne, shoot me. You know, one of those tough guy things. And so he does. At 8:24 a.m., Wayne Henley called the Pasadena Police Department and says into the phone, y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man. And then the three of them waited outside on the curb. Henley was read his Miranda rights and said, I don't care who knows about it. I have to get this off my chest. So why did he say that? They all go down to the police station, you know, and that's when Henley starts to spill his guts. Let's flash over to Dean Corll. Who is Dean Corll? Dean Corll, his life was from December 24th, so he's a Christmas Eve baby, 1939 to August 8th, 1973. So he is the firstborn child of Mary Robinson and Arnold Corll. He has a younger brother named Stanley. His mom had a problem with marrying people often and repeatedly. So she was married to Dean's father twice. So she wanted to keep the family together. So even when they were divorced, she moved the boys near him because she wanted him to have a relationship with him. But eventually she married, her third marriage was to Jake West, who is a traveling clock salesman. Jobs were weird back in the
Don't
70s.
Have that these days.
I'm a door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesman. Well, they moved to Texas. In fact, Vidor, Texas, which is commonly known today as one of the, it was a sundown town. So Vidor was a sundown town. I remember hearing about it because, like, after the James Byrd dragging death, the Ku Klux Klan had a rally there.
That's gross.
They started a candy company called the Corll Candy Company. Basically, it was a lot of pralines and shit like that. A lot of pecans in Texas, a lot of pecans in Houston. Mm-hmm. They moved to the Houston Heights in 1958, started the candy company there. From 1960 to 1962, Dean lived in Indiana with his grandma, started dating a girl there. She proposed to him, but he turned her down and returned to Texas ASAP. He just left. So he returned to Texas. His mom divorced Mr. West in 1963, and they started a candy company to compete with the ex-stepfather's candy company. He was drafted in 1964 and trained as a radio repairman. He eventually went from Texas to Louisiana to Georgia, back to Texas. So his mom lives in like the Houston area, basically Houston. Heights is a neighborhood in Houston. It's very, very, it's going through gentrification right now. You cannot afford a house there. Back then it was poor. Now it's like really, yeah.
When gentrification hits, it hits hard.
It hits hard, yes. So he was drafted in 64. Applied for a hardship discharge, saying his mom needed him to help with the candy business. So the Corll Candy Company was across the street from an elementary school, had a pool table in the back room. Dean would invite all these local boys to come hang out, shoot pool. And he was always burying stuff. And he said he was burying stuff because he didn't want like rats or bugs because all these pecans and the candy was bad. So he had to bury it to keep it from getting pests, which is like the biggest bullshit excuse I've ever heard. It's like that makes no sense.
That probably lines up with some of the excuses that John Wayne Gacy gave as far as why his house smelled like death.
Oh, yeah, it's the heater. Oh, I've got a sewage problem. Oh, it's the septic tank. No, there are like 30 dead boys buried under your house. That's why it stinks like that. So apparently he sexually harassed one boy at this company who told Dean's mom. And I guess their HR department was not very robust because that boy was then fired. The company closed in 1968 and Dean got a job with Houston Power and Light. Yay. He tested electrical systems. He moved several times a year. As somebody who doesn't like to move, I cannot imagine moving several times a year. That must be so much work.
I hate doing it every 3 to 4 years. So,
oh my God, I hate. Yeah, to move like 3 or 4 times a year, I can't even imagine. So he moved all around, ultimately being killed in the house at 2020 Lamar Street. There's one other person I need to mention. Besides Elmer Wayne Henley, who I mentioned earlier, is David Brooks. In 1967, at the age of 12 years old, David Brooks' parents were divorced, and he spent time between Beaumont, which is near the coast, and with his mom and his dad in Houston. Well, when he was with his dad in Houston, he stayed at Dean's place, wherever that place was, wherever Dean was. So basically, Dean gave him money, kind of saw him as a father figure. But starting in 1969, David Brooks would let Dean have sex with him. This is a 14-year-old boy. He has been groomed by this man.
Absolutely.
You know, there is no sex. This is just statutory rape and grooming. Mm-hmm. Well, he dropped out of high school, was bought a car by Dean. I don't remember what type of car exactly it was, but he was paid a bounty, ultimately, of $200 per boy he would bring him. Elmer Wayne Henley entered the picture in 1971. He was initially meant to be a victim provided by Brooks, but Dean had other ideas. He saw something in him, maybe. And as you learn about Wayne Henley later on, like over the years, because of all the people in this story, the only one still alive is Wayne Henley, Elmer Wayne Henley. He is still alive in Texas, in prison.
Like right now?
Yes, he is still alive. Yes, he is the only one still alive. Brooks died in 2021 of COVID. Rhonda Williams died at 61 in 2019. Timothy Curley died in South America of, I believe, a heart attack. Apparently, he was never the same after all this stuff.
Oh, I can certainly imagine.
Yeah, Timothy Curley. I mean, that's why he died in like South or Central America. He wanted to get the hell out of Texas. He wanted to get that far away from here as possible. In fact, like with Rhonda Williams, they have like, there was an interesting article I read called The Girl on the Torture Board. I think it was a Texas Monthly or a Houston Chronicle thing. And she talks about how when Timothy passed away, that he just wanted to get out of Texas. He wanted to get as far away from here. And Wayne Henley also got $200 per boy. God. So
he was using his money very openly and freely to get victims.
Can you imagine a $200? $200 is a lot of money now. Can you imagine what it was in 1973?
Let's see. 1970.
That's like a paycheck.
Worth of $200. Wow. In 1973, $200 would equal $1,278 today.
Holy shit, that's a lot of money.
For a kid, absolutely.
Now we'll go back to at the Pasadena Police Department, which then gets the Houston Police Department involved, because Pasadena is a suburb of Houston, but Wayne is like spilling his guts right and left. And he's like, well, I got to take you to show you. And first of all, when the police go into Wayne or go into Dean's house, it looks really weird. One, there's a dead body on the floor. Two, everything is covered in plastic. Three, there's a torture board with handcuffs and like gags and sex toys and all sorts of weird stuff going on in there. You know, unless you are an 80-year-old, 90-year-old grandmother and you have everything covered in plastic, that's a red flag right there.
Absolutely.
He's like, I know names of these boys. And he throws out names like Hillegeist and Yates and Winkle. And they're like, we do have something on these boys. We know these names. What? Like, some of their parents have been harassing the Houston Police Department. All of the victims were of Dean Corll, were between the ages of 13 and 20. Known victims began disappearing in 1970. Of course, this ended in 73 with Dean Corll's murder. So they're like, okay, so I recognize some of these names. He's like, no, I can show you where these bodies are. I'll take you to this boat shed. Now, keep in mind, when I say boat shed, Houston is unincorporated. It has no zoning laws. So you'll have like a storage place next to a church, next to like a strip club. This boat shed is basically really just a place where you leave boats. You would work on cars. I can't even equate it to like a storage unit like we would have nowadays. This is more like you would just unlock it, go open your shed and go in, and like it had a dirt floor, just store stuff there. Keep in mind, this is in August in Houston.
Hotter than hell.
Hotter than hell. On August 8th, they dug up 8 bodies. 9 more bodies were dug up on August 9th. Now, think about this. Hotter than hell, dead bodies outside. They bring in a convict work crew. It's basically like it's more like a trustee. They bring in trustees, convicts, or people in the local jail to do the digging. That has got to be the worst job they have ever volunteered for.
God, I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine. Like, haven't they been punished enough by being in jail? Like, I feel like that's cruel and unusual.
Wayne is sitting there. He's sitting there while they're doing this. And they dig up the first body and he goes, that's Jamalia. So this will be the last person that was killed. And it was the only one not kidnapped from the Heights area of Houston. Dean Corll's death toll is like 28, I believe. Then it was 27 because they were only counting so high. There was one that was found in like the 80s. So that brought it to 28. That's a lot. So there's 17 in the boat shed.
That's a lot.
Yes, that is a lot. And you have this actual clip on the TV show I saw, and it was on the news. It's like they asked one of the reporters if Henley could call his mother from his car phone. You see this, the reporter's filming this, and Henley is leaning over going, Mama, Mama, I killed Dean. It's like, okay. So all the reporters are smelling this. The cops are like, there's a lot of bodies here.
Mm-hmm.
On August 10th, they go to Lake Sam Rayburn, which is north of Houston, where Dean Corll's family had a cabin. They find another torture board there. They dig up 2 more bodies that were tortured and severely beaten. They go to High Island Beach, which is near Galveston. They found 4 more bodies there, which brought it up to 27 known victims. Later on, another body is located in the 80s in Jefferson County on a beach, which brings the death toll up to 28. So this is the worst killing spree known in North America, or known in America. It exceeded 25 murders attributed to Juan Corona in 1971, and it wasn't bested until John Wayne Gacy in 1978 with 33.
Wow.
On the High Island Beach is now totally underwater. It was in 2008 when Hurricane Ike hit the Galveston Island there, or the island where Galveston is. High Island Beach is now permanently underwater. So anyone that was still there is never going to be found because it's under sea level now. What do we know about Dean and his murder spree? We know that the first known victim disappeared September 25th. And I'm going to give all these people's names because they deserve to have their names known more than Dean Corll does, because these are his victims. Jeffrey Allen Conan was 18. He actually also wasn't from the Heights. He was a student at the University of Texas at Austin, but he was hitchhiking back home. They found him buried on High Island Beach. Then you go to December 13th, 1970. Two boys disappeared on the same day. James Eugene Glass, 14, and Danny Michael Yates, 14. They were going off together. They were either going to swimming. Yeah, I believe they were going swimming. They're 14. They go to the cops. And the cops are like, ah, your kids have just run away.
Yeah, so much concern there.
Yeah, it's like, ah, your kids have just run away. In 1971, on January 30th, Donald Wayne Waldrop and Jerry Lynn Waldrop, 15 and 13 respectively, disappeared. They were found buried in the boat shed. They were both strangled. March 9th, 1971, Randall Lee Harvey was shot in the head and buried in the boat shed. David William Hillgeist, 13, and Mallory Winkle, 16. Oh, these are the ones that were walking to a pool. So the first two boys that disappeared, they were going to like a church revival when they disappeared. I know. Hillgeist and Winkle disappeared walking to a swimming pool. They were both found buried in the boat shed. August 17th, 1971. Reuben Haney, 17, he called his mother to tell her that he was spending the evening with Brooks. Keep in mind, Brooks was brought into the police station by his dad. His dad is a stand-up man. One of the providers of boys had actually gotten away from Coral by 1973. He had gotten married. He had gotten her pregnant. He had moved away. And when all this shit went down, he came back and his dad brought him into the police station.
Oh, no.
Yep. And his dad's like, you're going to tell these cops everything. And he did. So they're both spilling everything. In 1972, so he seems to be sort of cycling. I don't know. I'm not I can't make any psychological diagnosis, but I'm looking at this going, wow, he is ramping up. 1972, Frank Anthony Aguirre, 18, disappears and is buried at High Island Beach. This is the young man who was engaged to Rhonda Williams. She is 14. He is 18. April 20th, Mark Stephen Scott, 17, a friend of both Henley and Brooks, disappeared. Remains were never found. He is the one who is suspected to be still buried on High Island Beach and will never be found because it's now underwater.
That's so sad.
I know. And his mother really wanted him to be found. There was even a boy that was misidentified as him for a while, which is really sad. May 21st. So we're going March, April, May. So he's doing one a month now. Johnny Ray DeLome, 16, and Billie Jean Bullach Jr., 17, both disappeared that day. He likes to take more than one boy at once, but keep in mind, he has assistance from his co-conspirators, the people he has groomed to do this for him. Maybe he feels confident. He's got them under his control. He's got them handcuffed, you know, maybe he feels more comfortable. But both boys disappeared, and they were both buried at High Island Beach. Okay, we skip from May to August 21st. So he maybe had a cool down period. Roy Eugene Button, 19. Disappeared on his way to work at a shoe store. He was shot twice in the head and buried in the boat shed. And then we go to October 2nd, Wally J. Simoneau, 14, and Richard Edward Hembry, 13, were both kidnapped, killed, buried in the boat shed. November 1st, so August, October, November 1st, Willard Carmen Branch Jr., 18. He was a mess. His junk was cut off. He did something that pissed Coral off, so he cut his junk off. Wow. He was identified because his junk was found next to the body in a plastic bag. That's sad.
That's really sad.
Yeah. Well, I guess he didn't get his fix on November 1st because, you know, he was so mad because on November 15th, Richard Allen Kettner, 19, is strangled and buried at High Island Beach. And then we jump forward to 1973, February 1st. Joseph Allen Lyle, 17. He was the one who was buried at the Jefferson County Beach. His remains were located in 1983, but weren't identified until 2009. Can you imagine having a loved one missing for that long? There's an excellent article called The Lost Boys from Texas Monthly on this case, and it's talking about how many of these parents still live in the Heights, or the ones that were still alive.
Oh, wow.
You know, so we're going through this huge list of boys. These were all kidnapped from the same neighborhood. These parents are reporting this to the Houston Police Department. What's the police department? One, the Houston Police Department did not have a missing persons division.
Really?
Which, yes.
God.
And two, did they have enough people to even bother to look? I mean, one, they didn't bother to have a missing persons division, you know. No.
Much care and concern yet again.
Yeah. So then we jump to June 4th, which February 1st to June 4th is kind of a jump. Well, it turns out that Dean had a problem. Dean had what is commonly known as a hydrocele, which is a collection of fluid accumulating between the tunica vaginalis. It basically makes sex really uncomfortable and awkward, and he had to have surgery. So he was basically out of commission for a large portion of the beginning of 1973. There was a medical condition for that. So we jumped to June 4th. William Ray Lawrence, 15. He's actually kept alive by Dean for 3 days before he was strangled with a cord and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. He was one of the two bodies there. June 4th, June 15th, we get Raymond Stanley Blackburn, 20. He was actually a married man from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. He was strangled by Coral at the 2020 Lamar Street residence. It's like he picked him up hitchhiking. June 15th to July 7th. Homer Lewis Garcia, 15, shot in the head and chest, left to bleed to death in Coral's bathtub, and then buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. July 12th. So we're going June 4th, June 15th, July 7th, July 12th. John Manning Sellers, 17. He was killed by 4 gunshot wounds to the chest and buried at High Island Beach. He was the only victim to be buried fully clothed.
Everyone else was completely nude.
Everybody else was nude, partially clothed. He is a questionable victim. You know, he was found at the time. It's questionable. I think he was a victim of Coral. I don't know why he was buried fully clothed, but he was. July 19th, my birthday. Michael Anthony Balch, 15. Coral had killed his older brother, Billy, the year before. So you have 2 Hillegeis, 2 Waltrups, and two Balches. So we have 3 sets of siblings
that are killed by this guy.
The police didn't look for these people. I can't even imagine. And having this happen in the same neighborhood where you knew this guy, these parents knew Dean Coral. Everybody knew Dean Coral because all these boys, some of them worked at the candy store. They were mutual friends, you know. They all know Brooks and Henley were from the Heights. July 25th, Charles Cobble and Marty Jones, 17 and 18 respectively. Cobble called his father in a state of hysteria, claiming him and Jones had been kidnapped by drug dealers. Both bodies were found in the boat shed. August 3rd, when Henley said that's Dremalia, that was James Stanton Dremalia, 13. He was the son of Seventh-day Adventists. He was riding his bike in Pasadena when he was kidnapped by Dean Coral and Wayne Henley. He was strangled and buried in the boat shed. So we have these 27, 28 people. This is ramping up. Do we think he didn't kill before then? I don't know. He might have. He liked to tell Henley and Brooks that when he was in the military, he got to know, like, this gay porn ring out of Dallas. But he was talking about how, oh, yeah, he's doing this for this gay porn ring. Well, I think that's just something that he told Brooks to make him feel better.
Yeah.
I don't know. Or, you know, how much can you lie to yourself? I mean, is Henley lying to himself? Brooks is lying to himself, but they're all coming clean at the end. Wow, that's a large body count. And it wouldn't have stopped because they were going to kill Timothy Curley and Rhonda Williams on August 8th. This escalation in murder, just honestly, it was self-limiting because even with the most inept police departments, somebody would have caught on somewhere, I would hope. But do you know what the Houston Police Department's response was to this?
Oh my God, what was it?
they cut down on gay clubs and gay life in Houston.
Are you serious?
They prosecuted homosexuals. This is not a homosexual crime. This is a pedophilic murderer.
Yes.
Yes. They cracked down on gays.
That's terrible. I didn't hear that part of it.
Oh, yeah. This is Houston in 1973. One, they're not going to bother looking for your kid. Two, they will arrest you if you're homosexual. And this is kind of weird because, or this is kind of funny because I think Houston was the first big Texas city to have an openly gay mayor.
That's some sweet irony.
I know. That is. Let's get into one of the rock stars in this case. Is Sharon Derrick, who's a forensic anthropologist with the Houston Medical Examiner, well, the Harris County Medical Examiner. She's the one who was responsible for helping identify people after 2008. How do you identify bodies in 1973, especially if they're really decomposed, don't have any clothes on them, have been tortured? Well, they can go by with what Henley and Brooks said, but Henley and Brooks, you know, they don't know everything. What if he did some of these on his own?
Right.
You know, we're trying to identify bodies without DNA in the 70s, without, you know, forensic reconstructions, without any of this. So there were misidentifications. Additionally, in 2008, there were still three people not identified. So she was able to put Randall Lee Harvey's name in 2008 to one of the bodies, which was good for her. She's really dedicated herself. I believe right now there's only one body that hasn't been identified. The body found in Jefferson County on that Jefferson County beach, which was believed to be a victim of Coral. Scattered skeletal remains were discovered within and close to plastic sheeting near an eroding sandbag, along with sections of rope. That body was identified as Joseph Lyles in 2009, like I said earlier. In 2010, DNA analysis showed that the body of an unidentified victim was actually Michael Balch, who had been incorrectly identified as a different body, as the second victim unearthed from the boat shed.
Oh, that's heartbreaking to family.
Yes. So they had to disinter that body, you know. Stephen Sickman, a 17-year-old who was last seen walking down the street and disappeared July 19th, 1972, was misidentified as Mark Scott. Now, Henley always said, you left Scott on the beach. They stopped digging when they got to 27 because they had reached their limit. They were done.
How are they just done?
They were done. We had reached 27. We don't want to like go way over the limit. We just want to go a little over the limit. This is the worst, but it's not really, really bad. It's only like two more than before.
Oh, my God.
There is one, yeah, the 16th body in the boat shed is still unidentified. He was likely to have been killed in 1971 or 72 based on the advanced rate of decomposition. One, you're in Houston and it's been several years. Yeah, things are going to decompose. He was found wearing swimming trunks, cowboy boots, a leather bracelet, and a t-shirt, leading investigators to think he was killed in the summer months. And in Wayne Henley's stuff, a Polaroid image, likely an unknown victim of Coral, is a little boy looking, or a boy looking terrified, attached or handcuffed to something. You just see him bent over looking scared. It was found in the personal possessions of Henley. They don't know who this boy is.
Oh.
So Dean's mom said he was framed. The boys are framing him for this. Of course, Dean's mom would. Well, yeah, she wasn't going to, like, her boy could never do anything like this.
He was a sweet boy.
He got a hardship discharge to help at the candy company. There were separate trials for Henley and Brooks. Both were brought to trial. Henley was brought to trial for murder times six. Brooks was brought to trial for murder times one. Brooks was found guilty of the June 73 murder of William Ray Lawrence. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to a lifetime in prison, of course. He died in 2021 of COVID. He was very quiet. He kept low key. He never spoke to the media. He never spoke. He never said anything bad. Meanwhile, Henley talked trash for the next 20. He's still talking trash. He'll change his mind. He'll go one way or another. Henley was found guilty of murder in, I believe it was 75. He was retried in 1979 because it was a mistrial, or they overturned it on appeal because they said the jury wasn't sequestered. Now, when you have something like this, I'm not sure what sequestering a jury in Russia cited this as the depravity of the American or the West, these murders.
Wow.
It's like, wow. Wow. Well, keep in mind, 1970s in the Soviet Union, there was some pretty bad stuff going on.
I was about to say, those are really mighty strong words for someone who literally brought us Andre Chikatilo. But I digress.
Yeah. I'm sure there are plenty others in Russia that we just don't know about that are still, I'm sure they're keeping that under wraps, or they didn't even bother to look. Like Houston didn't bother to look.
I mean, the Granny Ripper by herself is just chef's kiss, literally. No pun intended.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Henley is the only one still alive. Henley has talked to people over the years, said he would help people, said he wouldn't help people. He comes up for parole every few years, keeps getting, they're not letting him out, but he tries. It's like, I think why you don't hear about Dean Corll is because he never went to trial. You only have like you have some really good third-hand information. And these boys were tortured. Okay, so when I was at the hospital, we had one repeat frequent flyer who was incarcerated, mm-hmm. and he would keep shoving like razor blades up his urethra.
Oh, okay? My God.
Like he did this on his own. It's like, you got to keep these away from him. Dean Corll would like shove glass rods up their urethra and break them. That's one of the things they found repeatedly in these bodies. These boys, these children were tortured by this man and his two. I can't call them. They are accomplices. They're groomed. They're also, I would call them minions.
Yeah. That's terrifying. That's horrible.
You know, and if it weren't for, you know, Sharon Derrick doing her work, re-identifying people, initially identifying people, they're, you know, she is a huge rock star in Texas forensics, because she also did the, there was a case, Baby Grace, Riley Sawyers. She was beaten to death, then put in a cooler and like let go in Galveston Bay. And they found her body on an island. She did the facial reconstruction, and it looked exactly like her. It was amazing. She is a huge rock star in Texas forensics. She is one of the true heroes. She is the hero. Houston Police Department are not the heroes. Henley definitely isn't a hero because, you know, he was found guilty of 6 murders.
Yeah.
You know, he helped with this. Brooks is not a hero. Brooks' dad may be a hero for bringing his son in and saying, you tell him. How many parents would do that? You know, there are not a lot of warm fuzzies at the end of the story.
No.
How many more boys would have been killed if I can't, you know, when Wayne says, I can't have you killing all of my friends, Dean.
But some of them were okay. But like, I draw the line now.
If you're bringing all of your friends to this guy, maybe you need to look at yourself too.
Yeah.
You know,
and he got life in prison, right?
He got life in prison, but he keeps coming up for parole because that's what you do in Texas. He's going to suffer somewhat there.
He's not living a beautiful life for sure.
No. You can tell when you see, if you see like a Texas prisoner on TV, they all wear white and their white has turned gray because of the sweat stains and the repeated wash. If you ever see anybody on TV and they're interviewing a convicted felon and they're wearing white, it's got to be in Texas.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Man, the Texas penal system, I wouldn't want to be in it. I was on a jury once. that's pretty much all. But that's the Candyman, Dean Corll. You know, it's like Houston police didn't do their jobs. The parents knew their boys would not run away.
And you see that a lot. I've seen in other cases, too, where, you know, children disappear and they're gone for a day or two. And the parents just know inherently that my child didn't just up and leave. Like, we know our children, and the police are like, boys will be boys, or, you know, they're adventurous, or he's off exploring.
Ooh, he probably got a job somewhere.
Yeah.
He's 12. What are you talking about?
Right. Like, sir, he's 12. Yes. So sad. But I wonder, A, what the real body count of that is, of Dean Corll actually is. And had Henley not stood up to Dean, like, how many more would have been killed before he, if ever, had gotten caught?
Man, I was looking up something on this case, and they're like re-examining the areas in which bodies were buried. Like, they want to re-examine the area where the boat shed was, because they want to see if there were more bodies there, because Henley always said there were other bodies there. But how much do you trust Henley at the time, exactly? Depending on whether he wants to get on people's good sides or not, he fluctuates back and forth over the years. All I know is that Rhonda Williams swears that, you know, Henley saved her life, and that's what she knows, and he did. But he also killed her fiance / perpetrator. I don't know. Boyfriend, fiance, 18. That whole age thing is weird to me, because I don't know if things are really different now.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't alive then.
One of the big things with this case that I saw was the torture board. Like, you can actually see pictures of the torture board itself. Plyboard, it was 8 feet long, somewhere around 2 feet wide. It had holes drilled into each corner, and he would literally handcuff them and then bound their feet. And he would just torture them. And apparently, the more he actually liked you or was attracted to you, the longer you would be forced to stay on that table.
Yeah, that's why that boy who was emasculated pissed him off real bad and was killed real fast.
The thing that stands out in my mind the most is that he actually had, even though this was in the 70s, he had a whole box of sex toys. And one of the sex toys that he had that was sitting near the torture board was an 18-inch double-sided dildo.
Now, having worked at a public hospital, I do have to say I have received a large number of rectal foreign bodies.
It took me a second to process that.
I have seen some weird shit. No, really. I've seen some rectal foreign bodies. Nobody slipped in the shower. Nobody has ever slipped in the shower. No, you did not fall on that. I don't know how that glass ship in a glass bottle got up your ass.
I actually saw a TikTok earlier today, and it's a guy who works in an ER. And they're like, yeah, I was nailing something down and it was in between my legs and I fell, and it's just really unfortunate, you know? And the ER guy was like, can you just happen to not be wearing pants or anything as that happened? Like, it just ended up in your rectum somehow?
It's like, yes, I slipped in the shower. Why is it a screwdriver?
God.
We actually had one, it was Stanley screwdriver Phillips head. Once you washed it off, it was perfectly fine, but...
I still don't think I could use that. Nope.
No. It got disposed of appropriately, you know, those as things do. But it looks exactly like our lab screwdriver.
Really?
Yep. Exact same brand, Stanley screwdriver, Phillips head.
God, people are sick. People are so gross. Like, that's some Albert Fish shit right there. Mm-hmm. And I just can't. That's horrible. Dean Corll, I think that I didn't realize until I read a little bit more into him just how grotesque he actually was. He ripped out fingernails and sometimes apparently teeth. But his like kink was taking tweezers or pliers and plucking out each individual pubic hair. These are children, guys. These are children. And apparently Henley talked about in one of his interviews years later that almost all of the boys would pass out from just pain, just sheer pain.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're a child and you're being tortured in a way you can't even fathom. These were good kids. And all of these from one neighborhood.
It's like the Atlanta child murders, you know? The police didn't give a shit.
If three people disappear from one school, it would light up red flags now. 27? 25? Nah, they're just missing voluntarily. Those poor parents.
It's so sad. Well, thank you for picking it. I learned more about this case than I have, and I didn't, like I said, didn't really deep dive on this. And to think, I think the biggest takeaway that I ever had from this case is that, so I didn't know that John Wayne Gacy like looked up to him in a way, but I knew that he stole the handcuffs trick from him. I knew that part. John Wayne Gacy, when he would invite the, you know, the young men back to his house and try to get them drunk, he would do the handcuff trick of like, look, can you get out of my handcuffs? And then they were done, right? Like that's when he would attack them. But yeah, he took that trick from Dean Corll. Dean Corll used to do that to the children.
But there's another level with Dean Corll in the fact that he would like handcuff Henley and Henley would get out of the handcuffs because Henley had a key. And then it would be like, oh, well, you try it. You're my friend. He just did this to me. It was fine. We'll do it for you now. You know, so you have like, I've got a person here who's your age, who's your friend, who you trust, who you just saw get out of it. You can get out of it too. Nope.
Oh, that's terrible.
John Wayne Gacy did it himself.
Yeah. I didn't know that Henley was kind of like the catalyst there.
It's like, oh yeah, or Brooks. I mostly Henley, because Henley actually participated in, I mean, he was found guilty of 6 of the murders. You know, I think it would have made more news under Dean Corll's name if, you know, he had been brought to trial. That would have been a shit show.
Oh God. But Henley ended him.
Henley ended him with his gun on a plastic sheeted floor. So, you know, and that house is still there at 2020 Lamar.
Is it really?
Yes.
But it's like the Atlanta child murders. We were dealing with African-American children, which racism, Georgia, Atlanta, I mean, you know, no one cared to begin with. But so many missing kids and no one really cared for a while. Just let it continue for so long.
One thing that I forgot to bring up is that Dean Corll had a girlfriend who had 2 kids. Now, the kids were little, real little, and, you know, they were going out for several years, and he never tried anything with her. One time, they got a little worked up, but he said he just needed to stop. He wasn't going to compromise himself that way. She thought he was just a really quality, straight-up boyfriend. There are neon red flags.
Yeah, they're tap dancing with red flags.
Yeah, those are not party favors. Those are warning signs. Everybody knows this nice like scarf I have made out of these red flags is just not doing it anymore. Red flags.
Well, thank you for coming on and covering this case. It's fascinating and talking about what you do. I could listen to you talk about your life and job all day. Like you should start, you have your own TED talk or write a memoir.
Me and Iris need to get together and talk.
That is going to be, and I've discussed this with both Alana and Iris. This has to happen. I want both of my, what would we call you, you two? You need a fun nickname.
The path pair? I don't know.
The path pair to come on and just talk and share. And Iris, you know, I talk to Iris at length because, you know, she worked outside of Seattle and also in Utah and lots of autopsies and the type of people. And she got to know the cases behind them and the stories, a lot of sex workers, things like that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But she got to know a lot of the stories and people. And this is something that like, people don't realize, especially like the Murder Accountability Project, like the episode I've been researching for months now, too, is guys, so much more happens that is not reported. That's either not reported by local authorities as well as by the FBI. And it's actually like I'm not one of those paranoid people, but it's terrifying to think about what the actual numbers are.
Just think about if there's a murder in a really small town where there's like no cops or like nobody investigates or it's a poisoning or there's a lot of stuff that goes on out there, I'm sure. One of the other podcasts that is a Texan-based podcast that I listen to has a very good one on Robert Ben Rhodes, who was, you know, like he was a truck stop killer.
Is he the one that has that horrifying picture of the young girl?
Yes.
Oh, that picture is burned into my mind.
She is so scared in that picture.
Mm-hmm.
She is just, and you can tell her hair is growing back and she's dressed like kind of almost business formal, but it does not belong on her.
Mm-hmm.
And she is scared in that picture.
That is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. There's a movie out and I know I'm not going to ask any of you to watch it or even I can't recommend it because it's not rated. It would be definitely rated X or NC-17. But it's called The Bunny Game. And the main actress in it was actually kidnapped, raped, and assaulted by someone. Ooh. in Ooh. Similar to Dean Corll and you know, Ben Rhodes, like serial killer type of situation. Rodleen Justic is her name, and she's an actress. And so what did she decide to do? She decided to star in an indie film where the same thing happens to her, to relive it.
Really?
To process her own trauma. And
well, if you can't afford therapy, I don't know.
And she did. And in this film, I actually own the DVD of it because I just find it so powerful. Chose that. I've never heard of anyone doing that. But there's unsimulated sex in it. At one point, she's kidnapped by a truck driver and they drove out into the desert to film it. And he actually branded her in real life with a hot iron.
Ouch.
In the scene. And they filmed him branding her for real. It's a crazy piece of cinema, but every time I think of like Ben Rhodes or Green River Killer or something like that, I think about this film and just how terrifying that entire ordeal must have been. It's heartbreaking.
Man, the last time I went to Washington, I flew into SeaTac. I'm like, you know what I think of when I think of SeaTac? I think of the Green River Killer.
Mm-hmm. That's what I think about. And well, Alana, thank you again. I can't wait to have you on again. And we're going to have to talk about all of your background and have Iris on and talk about really gross, stinky, squishy things.
I'm going to tell you about the world's worst leg. Just because I can tell you about the world's worst leg. They did a hip disarticulation within 24 hours. Nobody does that fast, okay? So we had both the above-the-knee amputation and the hip disarticulation in the fridge.
Also, for dum-dums like myself, can you please define what a disarticulation is?
A disarticulation is where they take it off at the hip joint. They don't like to do hip disarticulations. You can't walk with a prosthetic as easily. They prefer to go below knee, then above knee. And then if need be, they do hip disarticulation in the very worst cases. They did this within 24 hours. So we hauled the leg out of the fridge. It stinks. Oh my God, does it stink? Now, you can't put limbs in formalin, right? So I'm looking at the requisition and I'm reading about this. It says, patient said this just started. What? What? So, but there are maggots. It says maggots on the requisition.
Are you serious?
What? Yes, it does say that. I'm like, why does it say? So this leg stinks. I didn't see any maggots, but the leg stinks. Down the back of the leg is a sinus tract about the skin is sloughing and you have like a, I want to say 5 centimeter long area of just pus just oozing out of the back of the leg. Okay. So I go and grab the Lysol to spray this leg because it stinks. Did you know that Lysol pisses maggots off?
Oh my God. Do they come alive?
Oh my God. The maggots were coming after me.
I didn't know that you would actually have maggot infested materials.
Oh yeah.
Is that something you deal with frequently?
Not often, but you do deal with it. I've dealt with it over 5 times.
Okay, so I have questions. Mm-hmm. Are these maggots that are taken from the sample, like the person shows up at the hospital to get, you know, whatever procedure done, amputation, removal, and the maggots are inside the sample already?
Yes. This did not just happen to this poor gentleman. This has been going on for a while. Maggots don't just happen. Something has to lay eggs. It has to get in there. Oh, man.
Oh, my God. And this is necrotic material, right? Like, it's dead. And the maggots are just feasting like an all-you-can-eat buffet?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes. That is why there is a 5 centimeter sinus tract all the way down the back of the thigh from the point of amputation to the back of the knee where the skin is just, it's pus and sloughing.
And they're just all down that tract?
No, they were all through the leg.
Oh, my God.
That's why when I sprayed the leg, they got angry.
Oh, my God.
You couldn't see them before until they got angry.
And then they just started coming out?
Yes.
How did you not burn your place of employment down to the ground?
Lysol pisses maggots off.
Oh, I have to know how you reacted when that happened. Were you already a seasoned maggot veteran at that point?
I was already a seasoned maggot veteran. I laughed. We got a maggot and submitted it for histology. The problem is that when they're being processed, you know, to process something from tissue to make it on the slides, it has to be made anhydrous. So we take all the water out of it and replace it with like xylene and other chemicals and eventually paraffin with maggots. You don't want to press them down too hard. They might explode. So I had to leave notes saying, please don't press down block. It's a maggot. It might explode.
Oh my God.
Please don't ruin my maggot. It was a great slide.
I just, girl, I don't know. I don't know how you do it. I really don't. That would just send me, in my lifetime, I've witnessed some shit. So everyone knows, I think I talked about in a previous episode that I was a 911 dispatcher for a while, answered calls and did the dispatching and stuff. And so like in early training class, I would have to do ride-alongs and whatnot. You know, I responded to a case. It was like a, basically the Mazda Miata, a very, very small sports car convertible that went underneath the back of a semi, and the decapitation was something like out of 13 Ghosts, like, you know, very angular. The top half of this woman's head was in the back seat. So I've witnessed that up close and in person. And I feel like when I see things like that, or maybe I've just gotten old and sensitive, but I couldn't do that. The maggots and whatnot, just mm-mm.
Here's the funny thing, you know, it's like we were all standing around trying to figure out what this dusty stuff was on like one of the pathologist's orchids. It's like, what is this dusty stuff? And we turn the leaf over and there are bugs underneath. And we all screamed and threw the orchid in the garbage.
You pathologist screamed at bugs on an orchid.
Me, a pathologist assistant, them, the pathologist. We all screamed. We both screamed. Plus the other person who was there screamed. The orchid went in the garbage.
But you can pluck maggots out of human flesh.
Yes, but show me a bug on a plant and I freak out.
We all have our things.
Yes, we do.
Couldn't do it. I think the worst thing I've ever seen in my life was on Reddit, and it was a suicide in a bathtub that had filled the tub of water, I'm assuming pretty warm, committed suicide, and no one found the body for months. A couple months, and partial decomposition. You basically had a stew at that point, in a way. And it was, to this day, I can't stop. There were maggots, and I can't imagine seeing even a slide of that like you do for your job.
A person who I work with used to pick up bodies for the medical examiner, and she, to listen to her talk is like, wow.
I bet she has seen some stuff like crime scene cleanup and stuff like that too. Look on YouTube, crime scene cleanup. They walk you through it as they do it after the body's been removed and you see the mess and stuff and what they do to remove it.
There's a guy I follow on Instagram for crime scene cleanup.
Oh, really?
And some of those decomps, you know, with like, you know, severe decomposition, you know, it's like, oh my God, you can just see the husks of previous generations of maggots.
Yes, you can. And especially when it's a lot of the bodily fluids have been expelled and whatnot, like they showed the mattress, someone died on their mattress and their body wasn't found, I think for 2 weeks, that was it. But yet the decomp had gone all the way through the top mattress, the bottom mattress, and was literally like starting to get into the box spring.
Yeah, when you hear about like, oh, there was decomp fluids in the closet, it's like, and they found it 3 years later. How do you not know before then? Didn't whoever lived there notice the closet smell like something had died in it?
Cannot imagine. I have never personally smelled death. I do not know what the smell of death smells like. At what point does that smell kick in?
Oh my God, it's so sickeningly sweet.
That's what I've heard. I've never smelled it. The accident that I went to and responded to was immediate. Like I was there pretty much like 3 minutes after it happened.
You know, it's like, because I was trained in microbiology, whenever I smell something, I'm always like, oh, that's sulfur reduction. Because I think about, you know, this is what's going on. This is what's going on. You know, what process? What are the things that are being produced? Putrescine and cadaverine and all those lovely aromatic hydrocarbons with the graphic names.
Yes.
That you learn about as a microbiology person. It's like, that's what people are like, oh my God, it smells like something died. I'm like, no, that's just sulfur reduction. You want to smell something that died. That doesn't smell like that.
Oh my God. You have a much stronger constitution than I do. That is for sure. Anything that you want to pimp out for yourself, like personal website, LinkedIn, like anything that you want out there at all?
If you're interested, I'm at PathGirl on most things, at PathGirl19. PATH pathology girl.
Everyone follow Alana because she's brilliant.
And I'm a nice person. So
She really is a nice person, despite what her stories may otherwise make you believe.
No, I'm a nice person. I know. No, I'm a nice person. I rescue kittens. Mm-hmm. I take care of stray cats. I've worked with lots of people over the years. I've taught doctors, you know, and I love your podcast. And yours was the first Patreon I ever did.
Oh, thank you. That means the world to me. Mm-hmm. Well, now you're going to become a permanent fixture here, so I hope you're prepared.
Okay.
Because you're going to be coming on multiple more times.
Okay.
Awesome.
But yes, this is my Texan homegrown case. Not really homegrown because I'm from Washington, but it's my Texas-based homegrown case.
It still counts. And thank you for teaching us, because I learned more about this than I previously knew. That's it for this time, guys. Until next crime.